deaths in Cologne in October 1943, while the women were sent to concentration camps where all but two of them died. Such were the demands now bearing down on Stulpnagel from both Berlin and Paris that he acquiesced again, hardening his hostage policy and this time directing it against Jews. The military government had consistently singled out Jews as a potential security threat since the start of the occupation. In 1940, for example, it expressed concern that German soldiers were frequenting Jewish shops. In 1941, unrest in Paris, Lyon, and Marseille, following a series of food shortages, was blamed mostly on Jews. And in August and September, several thousand Jews were arrested for possessing firearms, illegal leaflets, and other contraband. Now, in December, Stulpnagel agreed to impose a fine of 1 billion Reichsmarks on the French Jewish community, execute 100 Jews immediately, and deport a further 1,500. It is not clear how much Stulpnagel knew about the deportees' possible fate. On the one hand, foreigners had been regularly deported to Germany for labor during the First World War, and in December 1941, killing Jewish deportees to the east had yet to become general policy. On the other hand, the Night and Fog Decree was clear as to the fate of its victims. Stulpnagel again sought to water down the severity of the reprisals. Although he ordered the execution of 100 Jews, he otherwise attempted to backpedal to a policy in which the authorities would seek predominantly to break the resistance through criminal investigations and execute only limited numbers of hostages. Stulpnagel's aversion to mass executions was genuine. Ernst Junger, the learned author who served as an officer in the military government, observed that the policy left the general unnerved and profoundly shaken. Stulpnagel also claimed that transportation problems and the security risk of sending young communists eastwards rendered deportations impossible at the present time. Stulpnagel did, however, assure the OKW that the military government would arrest and deport further Jews once transport was available. Another form of atonement is necessary for attacks against Wehrmacht personnel, that is to say, through limited executions, above all through the evacuation of most communists and Jews to the east, when we are able to reach it. Based on my knowledge of the French population, I believe this deterrence, and not mass executions, will work. And in an order of 14 December, he asserted, "These measures in no way affect French people, but rather just those individuals who are in the service of Germany's enemies, who seek to plunge France into ruin, and who are intent on thwarting Franco-German reconciliation." Speidel backed Stulpnagel and argued that though the Germans should conduct reprisals, they should also offer the French concessions. But Stulpnagel had run out of road. Whatever the ambiguities of his actual position, Hitler now considered him a Francophile, and even more damningly, in the Führer's eyes, a soft touch. Keitel at the OKW and Wagner at the OKH also joined the growing chorus calling for a more ruthless reprisal policy in France. In February 1942, Stulpnagel finally resigned over the pressure he faced to continue the executions. His resignation letter maintained, "Without this trust and freedom of action, the position of the military governor in the occupied areas becomes more difficult, leads to weighty conflict of conscience, and undermines my energy, self-confidence, and determination." It may be tempting to conclude that Otto von Stulpnagel was an officer who embodied the more virtuous characteristics of the officer corps' old-school conservatism, but this was only true up to a point. The military government discriminated against Jews in numerous ways under Stulpnagel's command, and in some respects did so with relatively little pressure from above. If there were limits to Stulpnagel's anti-Semitism and to how far he was willingly prepared to go after the Jews, mass shootings were a course of action that he tried to resist or at least restrict, his attitude towards deportations casts him in a less benign light. However, as an at least semi-reluctant instrument of Nazi racial and security policy, Stulpnagel contrasts with some of his markedly more ruthless colleagues in the newly occupied Balkans during 1941. The most senior officer overseeing German occupation in the Balkans was the Wehrmacht commander Southeast, who also commanded the 12th Army. until July 1942, before he was appointed commander of Army Group A on the Eastern Front, Field Marshal Wilhelm List held the post. Because Hitler had never intended to conquer Yugoslavia and wanted to commit as many troops as possible to the east, he sought to place much of the occupation burden onto some of Germany's European allies and satellites, Hungary, Bulgaria, and predominantly Italy. In Greece, the Germans retained a presence for strategic reasons in the part of Thrace around Salonika, in western Crete, and in the area surrounding and including Athens and Piraeus. The Italians occupied most of the rest of Greece, though Bulgaria annexed part of the north. A Greek civilian government under Lieutenant General Georg Tsolokoglu was to operate under Axis supervision. Hitler did not earmark Greece for particularly harsh treatment. Nazi racial ideology held Greeks in relatively high regard. Hitler respected them as descendants of the founders of Western civilization and as doughty opponents in the recent military campaign. True to this spirit, when the Greek army capitulated in the spring of 1941, the OKW made a special point of instructing the troops to treat Greek POWs correctly. However, from the start, some German soldiers found Greece a disagreeable contrast with what they were used to. In mid-May 1941, with the occupation a few weeks old, Lance Corporal Josef B. of the 2nd Panzer Division wrote, "In Elensis, a boy with eggs came up to us. He wanted 10 drachmas, or 20 pfennigs, per egg. We sent him packing, I can tell you. We often take the wares from such people and pay absolutely nothing." He then added, "The rabble here is very inclined towards thievery," entirely missing the irony of the contrast between this and his previous sentence. "The day before yesterday, a Greek policeman, trying to stamp it all out, smoothly shot a woman on the street. The conditions here are quite something." Negative views of Greece as a backward den of criminality were not necessarily widespread among German troops at the start of the occupation. They say more about the narrow-mindedness of the soldiers who harbored them than about anything else. Nor, however, were such views entirely harmless. The soldiers who did harbor them doubtless believed in Germany's cultural superiority, and their stance would harden when Greek resistance to the Axis occupiers increased from 1942 onwards. Indeed, an emerging resistance movement was made even more likely by Greece's mountainous terrain and long tradition of fighting foreign occupiers. Crete, in the summer of 1941, was the first setting for Greek civilian resistance and brutal Wehrmacht countermeasures. On this occasion, the reprisals were the work of Luftwaffe paratroopers fresh from conquering the island. Resistance began flourishing on the mainland, partly because of the devastating economic conditions that afflicted wartime Greece. The country, like other occupied countries, was forced to pay the Germans' occupation costs. The Wehrmacht compelled the Greeks to provide interest-free loans, and also burdened them with the cost of massive construction programs for German air and naval forces. By the end of the occupation in October 1944, circulating banknotes would reach a value approaching 3 trillion drachmas. Greece's suffering was particularly acute because it relied extensively on imports, imports of which it was deprived as long as the British continued their naval blockade. Such was the state of Greece's infrastructure that distributing food around the country was difficult enough in peacetime. But when Bulgaria seized its grain surplus, some regions faced a catastrophic food situation as their bread supply disappeared entirely. During the winter of 1941 to 1942, 360,000 Greeks died of famine. "Have you heard about the lack of food in Greece?" wrote Lieutenant Peter G. of the 714th Infantry Division in March 1942. "In Athens, 200 people die of starvation every day. That's a fact. They're dropping dead in the street, and most of the country is just steppe. How is the population supposed to feed itself?" Even more Greeks would have died had the British not relaxed their blockade somewhat and allowed in emergency aid from the International Red Cross. Resistance to the Axis occupation would begin to spread across the whole of Greece in 1942. But in 1941, the main center of anti-Axis resistance in Southeast Europe was Yugoslavia. It was here that merciless pragmatism would combine with Nazi ideology to forge a security policy much more ruthless than anything Otto von Stulpnagel would have countenanced. Multi-ethnic Yugoslavia, like Greece, had never figured in Hitler's long-term plans, so he committed minimal German forces to its occupation and left most of the burden to the Italians, Axis satellite states, or collaborationist native administrations. The occupation of Yugoslavia was therefore weak and fragmented from the start, and helped to create the conditions not just for anti-Axis resistance, but also for the enmities between Yugoslavia's many mutually antagonistic ethnic and political groups to sow bloody chaos across much of the country. The Italians proved particularly inept administrators. They exploited the economic resources of their territory severely and sought arrogantly to foist Italian culture upon it, and yet lacked the military strength to keep it under control. The Germans, too, exploited the country's economic resources energetically. They gained access to militarily important materials such as asbestos, iron ore, and zinc. They particularly valued the Bor copper mines at Niš in Serbia. The Germans deported few Serbs to the Reich itself because they needed manpower for Serbia's own mining industry. But their requisitioning of food, together with the British naval blockade, unleashed enormous supply problems. By the end of 1942, for instance, only a quarter of Serbia's urban population was being supplied with bread. These conditions, too, would become a recipe for resistance. Moreover, the topography of Yugoslavia's mountainous regions made them ideal guerrilla country. From the end of August 1941, the rump Serbian state was officially governed by a German-controlled regime headed by former Yugoslav Army General Milan Nedic. The practical reality, however, was that Serbia was under the full military jurisdiction of Serbia Command. Accordingly, Serbia saw the Germans' strongest military presence in occupied Yugoslavia in 1941, encompassing three occupation divisions, some substandard territorial battalions, and a series of kommandanturen of various sizes. The Germans also retained an additional division in the largest area of the former Yugoslavia, the independent state of Croatia, Nezavisna Država Hrvatska, or NDH. The NDH was governed by the extremist fascist Ustasha regime, which the Axis had installed because it could not find a saner alternative. Although the Germans and Italians stationed occupation troops in the NDH, it was nominally an independent Allied state. In Serbia, the German occupation's early months were relatively quiet, and the army's occupation formations restrained in their treatment of the population. Serbia Command's intelligence section observed that the population acknowledged German order and the disciplined behavior of Wehrmacht personnel. The important exception, here as in the Soviet Union, was the country's Jews. Wehrmacht authorities were instrumental in marking out and discriminating against Serbia's 23,000-strong Jewish population. The measures they enacted included dismissing Jews from public and private operations, transferring their goods and property to Aryan ownership, ghettoizing them, and inflicting upon them forced labor and the wearing of the Yellow Star. Gerhard Reichert of the 11th Infantry Division describes how all the Jews have been penned up. In the towns, they've even put aside quarters for them, which they're absolutely forbidden to leave. The roads leading out have been blocked off with a tangle of wire, and a guard stands before it. I wouldn't want to be a Jew. Not all soldiers were as contemptuously disposed towards the Jews as they might have been. In late June, Serbia Command's operations section complained that some troops, housed in former Jewish homes that had been earmarked for their own accommodation, were still allowing Jews to stay in them. Yet the effect of years of anti-Semitic indoctrination is as easy to imagine here as it is in the occupied Soviet Union. Corporal Ludwig Bauer of Supply Battalion 563 gave voice to it when he wrote, "Yesterday there was a raid on the Jews where we were. They were all hauled off to the edge of the town. It was really interesting to see what specimens they are, truly the scum of humanity." The weeks immediately preceding the invasion of the Soviet Union saw a small but perceptible increase in unrest caused by bandit groups, many of whom seemed to have been simple marauders. Yet this was all it took to reawaken the German military's abhorrence of armed civilians, particularly when vast quantities of small arms abandoned by the Yugoslav army remained unaccounted for. But by far the biggest surge in anti-Axis resistance during 1941 came after the Ustasha in Croatia embarked upon a savagely atavistic campaign to purge the NDH of communists, Jews, Roma, anti-fascist Croats, and above all, ethnic Serbs. They butchered around 300,000 Serbs, but in the process precipitated chaos across Yugoslavia that would not abate until the war was nearly over. Many Serbs now feared that the Axis occupation had placed them at the mercy of a regime that was seeking to exterminate them. The summer of 1941 thus saw ethnic Serbs rise up across much of Yugoslavia. In Serbia itself, the Yugoslav communists under their leader Josip Broz, or Tito, took control of the revolt and gave it direction through their partisan movement. The communists had had ample practice in clandestine operations during the interwar years, and many early partisan commanders had military experience from the Spanish Civil War. By early August, the communists could claim 8,000 members, divided into 21 partisan detachments in Serbia alone. By aiming their initial attacks against communications, supply, and the softer military target of Serbian collaborationist forces, the partisans notched up numerous successes and swelled their support further. From early August, German troops themselves were targeted. Whenever possible, the Germans exacted fierce reprisals. The relatively few SS and police personnel in Serbia carried out the bulk of them at first, though Wehrmacht units cooperated in rounding up and handing over reprisal victims. An early instance took place when 100 Jews and 22 communists were executed in Belgrade on 29 July in reprisal for an arson attack on German trucks by a 16-year-old Jewish boy. Serbia Command did urge German forces to distinguish between innocent and guilty, but in September the German situation grew more perilous and their response more ferocious. That month, Draža Mihailović's nationalist Serb Chetnik movement aligned itself with the partisans. The Chetniks and partisans were enemies, but Mihailović knew the Chetniks could not stand by and wait for the partisans to liberate the whole of Serbia. The Germans were unable, for the most part, to rely upon the policing and security forces of the Nedić government to support them effectively. And as their garrisons became progressively isolated, they faced the real prospect of losing control of the country. Previously, the bandits were only appearing occasionally and in small numbers, reported the 704th Infantry Division's 724th Infantry Regiment on 20 September. Now they are drawing ever nearer to Užice and Požega. Their strength can often be counted in the hundreds, and their equipment is often better than that of our own troops. "The shit the bandits are dealing out is just beyond belief now," wrote Lieutenant Peter G., at this time a staff officer in 65 Corps, in a private letter. "Today a general told us that two companies have been missing for 14 days. Just imagine that. Two companies taken prisoner, with five officers and so on. We're searching for them with aircraft day and night. You just want to scream right at the heavens." Field Marshal List was somewhat lacking in strong Nazi convictions, but he was also somewhat lacking in political sense. Granted, on 5 September he urged active, intensified propaganda in the Serbian language with every means available, wireless leaflets, newspapers, posters, and so on, increased use of informers, full use of the influence of the Serbian government, but he also believed the insurgents' attacks embodied the passionate, hot-blooded, and cruel nature that animated the Serbs on account of their history. That month, the OKW appointed General of Infantry Franz Boehmer to the new post of Plenipotentiary Commanding General in Serbia. Boehmer took charge of a greatly reinforced German counteroffensive. He implemented the OKW directive of 16 September 1941, by which 100 hostages were to be executed for every German killed by insurgents and 50 for every German wounded. Boehmer also incited his predominantly Austrian-born troops to avenge themselves against the Serbs for the humiliations of 1914. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand by a Bosnian Serb nationalist, the ignominious defeats the Serbian army had inflicted upon two successive Austro-Hungarian invasions, and the casualties Austro-Hungarian troops had suffered against Serb irregulars. "Your objective," Boehmer declared, is to be achieved in a land where in 1914 streams of German blood flowed because of the treachery of the Serbs, men and women. You are the avengers of those dead. A deterring example must be established for all of Serbia, one that will have the heaviest impact on the entire population. All Burma's units followed his orders to the letter, or worse. Peter G. reported matter-of-factly in a letter of 13 October, "In our area, 22 comrades, including two officers in a car, were attacked from behind on the street and murdered. 2,200 communists have already been shot. Overall, 22,000 reprisal victims perished by German hands during the autumn of 1941. Only in isolated cases did German officers question the wisdom of such a surge in indiscriminate brutality. For instance, the Kreiskommandant in Kragujevac, Captain von Bischofshausen, prevailed upon the 1st Battalion of the 724th Infantry Regiment to execute reprisal victims from communist-infested villages rather than from Kragujevac itself, because not a single Wehrmacht member or ethnic German has been wounded or shot there. And one of Burma's subordinate units, Lieutenant General Walter Hinghofer's 342nd Infantry Division, even outdid Burma for brutality. The 342nd's divisional command ordered that 100 hostages be shot for every German wounded by the insurgents, as well as 100 hostages for every German killed. And in operations between 10 and 19 October, the 342nd reported that its troops had killed 546 insurgents in combat and shot a further 1,081 following their capture, a total from which they had recovered four guns. As a 14th Wave Division, the 342nd was not one of the German Army's finest formations, but it was fairly effective compared with the occupation divisions already in Serbia. The most important reason why it comported itself so viciously then was not because it was trying to compensate for particularly substandard fighting power, but because General Hinghofer was Austrian. Burma's measures had some effect. Mihailovic feared that reprisals on such a scale would eventually cause the biological death of the Serbian people. Already emboldened by the support of the British and of the royal government in exile, he broke with Tito's partisans. The Mihailovic Chetniks in Serbia now became largely passive towards the Axis. This immediately enabled the Germans to go after the partisans. The partisans, flushed with their initial success, had rashly concentrated all their forces in a free zone around Užice in western Serbia. This made it much easier for the Germans to crush them in open combat. For while partisans might be good at irregular warfare, they had a very long way to go before they could hold their own in face-to-face combat. The Germans crushed them with ease in an operation between 25 November and 4 December. Tito and a partisan remnant barely escaped into the mountainous regions of the NDH and embarked upon a painful halting process of rebuilding. Burma directed the brunt of his reprisals against Serbian communists and against male Jews and male Roma. Even though they were persecuted less thoroughly than the Jews were, the Roma were a group whom Nazi ideology similarly deemed racially inferior and whom the army viewed as a threat to security. The military administration in Serbia had already subjected these groups to discrimination like that which they faced in other parts of occupied Europe. 6,000 of Serbia's 23,000 Jews were killed during the reprisals. Burma targeted the reprisals in this way because he believed that communists and Jews in particular were dangerous opponents who should be dealt with mercilessly. But he also calculated, like Stulpnagel in France, only with more relish, that this severity would bend the majority population to German control by making a particularly bloody example of the Jews. And yet much of the groundwork for targeted reprisals had been set by the OKH before the Balkan campaign, when, on 2 April, General Halder had directed SS and police units to seize not just emigrants, saboteurs and terrorists, but Jews and communists also. Thus, in turn, did the army, not the SS and police, set the pace for the Serbian Jews' eventual extermination. From 1942 onwards, while the Ustasha annihilated the remaining Jewish population of the NDH in barbaric concentration camps such as Jasenovac, Einsatzgruppe Belgrade assumed responsibility for disposing of Serbia's remaining Jewish population. As its chosen method of extermination, it eschewed the army's bullets and the Ustasha's medieval-style butchery in favor of the gas van. The second half of 1941 saw German occupation in Western and Southern Europe take a turn into profoundly dark territory. The catalyst was the invasion of the Soviet Union. This created a new communist enemy on the ground across occupied Europe, stoked officers' anti-Bolshevik attitudes, and steeled them to be more ruthless in the cause of smooth-running occupation. In other words, here as elsewhere, commanders' ideological beliefs combined with the supposed dictates of military necessity to harden their conduct. They particularly ensured that the German army directed its increasingly ruthless reprisal policy against Jews more than any other group. In France, General von Stulpnagel still possessed sufficient moderating conservative sensibility for him to try and ameliorate the worst effects of the course the German occupation was now taking. His restraint only went so far, but in Serbia, General Boehme showed no restraint at all. Indeed, the picture in Southeast Europe was grimmer still. Greece's early economic devastation laid the groundwork for a growing resistance movement from 1942 onwards. In Yugoslavia, the resistance already confronting the Germans precipitated much more ferocious German countermeasures than in France. Here, Hitler's attempt to occupy the country on the cheap created a power vacuum that the ostensibly allied Ustasha regime filled with its own barbaric variety of mayhem. The resistance to Axis rule that the Ustasha's depravity unleashed particularly frightened the Germans and tapped into their abhorrence of irregular warfare. The German army's regional makeup was also crucial. The fact that Austrian-born officers and soldiers were particularly thick on the ground in occupied Yugoslavia meant that the army's response was not only about military necessity or about guerrilla phobia, but also about terrorizing an enemy of long historical standing. Here, too, calculation and ideology led commanders to target many of the reprisals themselves on Jews, only this time to a much more bloodthirsty extent. Chapter 11. Winter Crisis, 1941-1942. Everything's failing. Troops are at the end of their strength. Everything lost? No, it can't be so, read the borderline hysterical diary entry of General Reinhardt, now commanding Panzer Group 3 for 9 December 1941. The Soviet counteroffensive of that month precipitated the German army's first real crisis of the Second World War. With a supreme effort, the army was able to weather it. Although the front line buckled in the face of the Soviet counteroffensive, it did not collapse. But the cost of the fighting during the winter and the months preceding it had been immense, and the experience further hardened the character of the army and its officer corps. Behind the lines, meanwhile, a crisis of a different kind unfolded. The High Command's contempt for Slavic peoples and its utter failure to plan adequately for the huge numbers of Soviet POWs taken by the Wehrmacht had already stored up the ingredients for mass death in the prison camps. The conditions of winter unleashed its full force. Meanwhile, the entry of the United States into the conflict suddenly overshadowed Germany's entire war effort. The surprise attack that Germany's ally Japan sprang upon the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor on 7 December 1941 did not bring the United States into the war against Germany straight away. 4 days later, Hitler made the decision for the United States by declaring war himself. He did this partly because the United States was already providing massive economic aid to Britain and the Soviet Union. Secondly, he believed the Japanese could pin down the Americans effectively, a belief his new allies' lightning surge of initial conquests seemed to confirm, and that declaring war on the United States more surely guaranteed Japan's continued participation in the conflict. Thirdly, Hitler was taking the bull by the horns, partly because it was in his character, and partly because he feared that not declaring war would damage his prestige in the eyes of the German people by making him look hesitant. Fourthly, he considered the United States to be weak and degenerate on account of its multiracial society and thus eminently beatable. The first motive was reasonable enough. The second had some strategic sense to it, however over-optimistic Hitler's belief in Japan's long-term military potential was. But the third motive was probably misplaced, and the fourth was wrong on every level. For leaving aside the obvious fact that the United States was a racially segregated society itself, and that Hitler's belief in its multiracial degeneracy was warped ideological nonsense, the United States was anything but eminently beatable. The generals on the Eastern Front were largely too preoccupied with the fighting there to pay much heed to the United States' entry into the war, though General Heinrici did write to his wife on 11 December, "I do not expect that it, Japan, will turn against Russia any time soon. But this stops, or rather hampers, supply transports from America and England to Russia." He did also remark, however, "Our yellow allies have started the war surprisingly and successfully." Considering Hitler's conviction that Jews controlled the government and economy of the United States as surely as they controlled those of Germany's other opponents, his declaration of war on the United States may have been the single most important factor that infused him and the Nazi leadership with truly genocidal resolve against occupied Europe's Jews. On the other hand, the final draft of Generalplan Ost, published at the end of 1941, envisioned expelling 31 million people from Eastern Europe to Western Siberia, including an estimated 5 to 6 million Jews living in the Soviet Union, to make way for German settlers. This plan certainly bore all the hallmarks of genocidal thinking, for the forced march and pitiless environment into which the expellees would be ejected would have unleashed mass death upon them. If anything, the plan was actually behind recent events, because it took no account of the fact that the SS and police, together with their native auxiliaries, had murdered several hundred thousand Soviet Jews already. But even an Eastern territorial solution that envisioned the mass death of Jews through natural wastage was not the same as a systematic plan to exterminate them directly. Overall, however, towards the end of 1941, the Nazi leadership was rapidly coming to believe that the pressures upon its efforts to solve the Jewish problem by any means short of extermination, not least the fact that the Soviet Union's continuing resistance made any Eastern territorial solution a non-starter, were insurmountable. Most historians thus concur that around the end of 1941 was when the Nazi regime reached the fundamental decision to exterminate Europe's Jews. The clearest evidence for this is the minutes of the conference of high-ranking Reich officials that Heydrich chaired at the Villa Wannsee outside Berlin in January 1942. And by the spring of 1942, not only the decision for Europe-wide genocide, but also the preferred means, had finally been arrived at. Mass shootings of the sort the Einsatzgruppen had been committing did not make for effective genocide. The available manpower was too small, and up-close and personal shooting of men, women, and children frequently traumatized the perpetrators to a point where they could no longer function properly. But the scientific means of mass murder had been advancing. In September 1941, the SS had experimented on groups of Soviet POWs, whom the army itself had handed over to them, by killing them in purpose-built gas vans. Now, in the spring of 1942, the SS implemented this method of extermination for the Jews on the grand scale. It also began organizing the systematic deportation of Jews from across occupied Europe to fill the gas chambers of the new extermination camps in the general government in Poland. The army leadership was not party to the decision-making that took place during the winter of 1941 to 1942, but without the cooperation of the army leadership, of many field commanders and of various army units, particularly in 1941, the SS would never have completed all the stages necessary for the process to reach its genocidal culmination. Efforts to exterminate the European Jews assumed further urgency for the SS throughout 1942 as the war's likely duration and final outcome became increasingly uncertain. For strategically, the Red Army's counteroffensive before Moscow and the United States' entry into the war heralded a tectonic shift in the balance between the Axis and Allied sides. Unless the Japanese could indeed contain the United States and the Germans make a rapid, spectacular recovery in the Soviet Union, the potentially colossal economic and military might of the Allies threatened eventually to overwhelm the Axis. Stalin, however, was too impatient to wait to see. He believed he could inflict upon the Germans the fate that had befallen Napoleon Bonaparte's invasion of Russia in 1812 and finish them off that winter. Here he was badly overestimating the Red Army's abilities at this stage in the war, and badly underestimating the Germans' fortitude in defence. Even so, especially throughout December and January, the Wehrmacht barely staved off calamity. The Soviet counteroffensive's main targets were Army Group Center and, to a lesser extent, Army Group North. Both army groups fought to protect the communication and supply lines that enabled them to move troops up and down the front and bring reinforcements from the west. It proved a Herculean task. The fiercest fighting of all was in the central sector of the front. "Chaos is reigning on the path of retreat," read the diary entry for 19 December of Lance Corporal G of the 11th Panzer Division with the 4th Panzer Army. "Trucks of all kinds are being destroyed. Orders are pouring out over one another. One march battalion after another is being raised and thrown into battle to plug the gaps in the front line." The army faced a crisis not just on the battlefront, but also in its replacement system. It had just about covered the mounting losses of 1941 by rotating frontline units with occupation units stationed across Europe and by combing out large numbers of rear area personnel. By winter, however, no such sources of manpower remained. Most of the class of 1922 had also been called up. One of the first high-level casualties of the winter crisis was Field Marshal von Brauchitsch. He was already suffering from serious health problems, including having a major heart attack in mid-November, and from General Halder's persistent blame for the failure before Moscow. On 19 December, Brauchitsch was sacked, and Hitler replaced him with the one individual whom he believed could salvage the situation most assuredly, himself. The Hitler myth remained enormously potent among ordinary German soldiers, and news of his self-appointment boosted their morale. Thus, for instance, did 2nd Lieutenant Helmut H. of the 258th Infantry Division under the 4th Army in the Army Group Center Sector describe his response to a speech Hitler gave on 30 January, the 9th anniversary of the Nazis' coming to power. "Adolf spoke today. I listened to it all, even with the interruptions. Only the morale of a degenerate could fail to be lifted by those words." In early December, Hitler seems to have been despondent about Germany's future prospects in the war. But when he declared war on the United States and then assumed command of the army, he emerged from his trough. Most of the German generals wanted to pull back Army Group Center between 80 and 120 kilometers, 50 and 75 miles, to the K-line, stretching from Rzhev down east of Vyazma to Yuchnov. Hitler and Halder refused, and were right to do so. The K-line was barely prepared, and retreat would have meant abandoning German vehicles and artillery stuck in the snow. Furthermore, such was the pressure the Soviets were putting on Army Group Center's front that any German retreat might turn into a rout. On 18 December, Hitler issued his stand-fast order. "Commanding generals, commanders, and officers are to intervene in person to compel the troops to fanatical resistance in their positions without regard to the enemy breakthrough on the flanks or in the rear. This is the only way to gain the time necessary to bring up the reinforcements from Germany and the West that I have ordered." Yet because Hitler was proved right this time, the long-term effects would be calamitous. Too often hereafter, Hitler would refuse to countenance withdrawal under any circumstances. The winter of 1941 to 1942 also presaged a further ominous development for the army's future modus operandi. The army's thoroughgoing use of radio enabled Hitler and Halder to impose a stricter, more hands-on command system. Thus, while radio had once enabled individual commanders to respond rapidly and flexibly to how the battle was developing, Hitler and Halder would now use it to impose suffocating top-down control. Over the course of the winter, Field Marshals von Rundstedt, von Bock, and von Leib were also relieved, or asked to be relieved, of their army group commands. Their respective replacements were Field Marshal von Reichenau, Field Marshal von Kluge, and Colonel General, later Field Marshal, von Küchler. Although these men were only slightly younger than their predecessors, the officer corps' lower command levels underwent more far-reaching change over the winter. Between September 1941 and January 1942, 6 army-level commanders and Panzer Group-level commanders also went. One of the most notable casualties was Guderian. His combative demeanour had crumbled with the Soviet counteroffensive, Begging to withdraw rather than stand fast, he drew the ire of his new army group commander and old bugbear, Kluger, who concluded, perhaps correctly, that the man's courage had deserted him. In their place, a generation of commanders largely born in the 1890s, who had served as front-line rather than staff officers during the First World War, came more strongly to the fore. Among the new appointees, albeit one who had largely served as a staff officer during the First World War, was General von Manstein, who became commander of the 11th Army in September 1941. But the appointee who most famously embodied those leadership qualities that Hitler particularly favoured was Colonel General Walter Model, who became commander of the 9th Army in January 1942. Like Hitler, Model came from a middle-class rather than an aristocratic background, and although he was not the most fanatical Nazi, his ardent anti-Bolshevism notwithstanding, he approached warfare in a ruthlessly utilitarian manner. There was more to him than just willpower. He proved himself a defensive warfare expert par excellence, a quality that would gain increasing currency over the next 3 years. Model combined these characteristics with a caustic treatment of his subordinates. General Günther Blumentritt, at that time chief of staff for the 4th Army, considered Model to be a bully, while one of Model's subordinate generals described his effect as like that of an icy wind, and Model himself as just an awful man. Yet a report from Model's superiors in Army Group Center in April 1942 attributed to him clear judgment, quick understanding, and great agility, and described him as a doer. There was also a cull of divisional commanders, 70 of whom were removed from their posts at the start of 1942. Yet the senior officer corps was not undergoing some kind of sudden ideological foment. The predominantly aristocratic, conservative contingent that had occupied the field army's top posts before the winter of 1941 to 1942 had already subscribed to ruthless National Socialist principles. Moreover, they had endorsed the criminal orders and increasingly practiced a National Socialist kind of warfare that placed willpower above sound operational practice as a guiding military principle. At the same time, the senior officer corps was becoming younger and less aristocratic, and in the process was further losing any of the distinctive officer ethos that might at least have diluted National Socialism's effect on its mindset. Hitler also sought to reinvigorate the officer corps more generally. War must not just be a killer, but also a renewer of life, he proclaimed at the end of 1941. True to his social Darwinist worldview, he believed war should weed out the old and bring in the young, and that officers should be promoted on merit irrespective of their social origins. On 30 March 1942, new measures were announced that were designed to fast-track suitable candidates for promotion. A lieutenant who commanded a battalion could now be promoted to captain, a major or lieutenant colonel commanding a regiment to colonel, and a colonel commanding a division to major general. Whether or not he was an active officer or reservist was immaterial. When it came to officer selection criteria, Hitler placed less value on intelligence than on personal courage and Nazi conviction, qualities that were at the heart of National Socialist military thinking. In reality, given the scale of losses, Hitler could ill afford to be so choosy, and his ideal officer corps never emerged. But as casualties mounted, the social makeup of the officer corps certainly became more diverse. Frontline officers had little time to muse over any of this during the winter of 1941 to 1942. "We are going to our doom," wrote General Heinrici to his wife on 24 December, "and the highest authorities in Berlin do not want to see it." The soldiers, of course, experienced the dire conditions even more directly. Lance Corporal B of the 2nd Panzer Division under Panzer Group 3 depicted them in a letter of 21 December. "Due to the great cold, very many trucks broke down and had to be destroyed, for we were conducting a planned withdrawal to a shortened front while the Russian was conducting offensives at the same time. On the 12th, there was thaw and rain, then immense cold and thin ice, then snowfall. On the 14th, our panzers were overtaken by fate. We were the last covering the retreat. The Russians attacked. Then we, too, received the order to retreat. We pulled back to a snow hole and didn't leave it. I called to other panzers over the radio to help us pull out, but it was already too late. We were hit by anti-tank fire in our motors. We took the necessaries out of our panzer, and then set fire to it. In the meantime, the Russians had got within 50 metres, 160 feet of us, and charged with a roar of hurrah. We ran towards the two other panzers and back over the bridge that was immediately destroyed behind us. It was awful, enough to make you want to cry. By a miracle, we had escaped, minus our panzer, unwounded through the enemy fire. The picture of the burning town in the breaking evening is something I will never forget. You cannot imagine what we experienced in the last few days. In any case, you won't see it in the Wochenschau, the weekly German newsreel. At least Corporal B's unit was still mechanized, if only barely. More generally, panzer and motorized infantry divisions were now experiencing the process of demodernization that would beset them over the coming months and years. As their vehicles broke down due to overuse and cold, they regressed to a more primitive technological state. This was the experience of the 25th Infantry Division under the 2nd Panzer Army in Army Group Center. Many of our trucks could no longer cope with this cold, attested Corporal Eberhard T. on 26 December. We are therefore barely motorized now, but instead on sledges. Yes, the plain, honest cart horses do a good job of pulling us. He also expanded on the cold's dreadful effects. The retreat in this savage cold was the worst and most awful time I have ever experienced, often retreating day and night uninterrupted with an icy northeast wind and snowstorm. Because the OKH had not anticipated a campaign going on into winter, the army was forced to rely not on specialist seasonal gear, but on collections of civilian coats and other items from back in the Reich. The effects left plenty to be desired. For one thing, rank-and-file troops could find themselves last in the pecking order. "Some lovely gear has arrived from the homeland," announced Lance Corporal Otto H., a medical orderly of the 198th Infantry Division, on 10 February. "The officers, of course, get the best stuff, and the ordinary soldiers get the leftovers." Many items arrived too late. Lance Corporal Franz S. of the 12th Panzer Division wrote, "Yesterday we received the winter clothing from Germany that you have been collecting. Unfortunately, it arrived rather late, and we've had many casualties to frost. In our company, many toes have been lost, and a good friend of mine even had to have a leg amputated." Mass casualties from enemy action and cold strained the Army's frontline medical services to the utmost. Otto H. described the conditions in his medical station that winter. "The cold is ongoing. The poor wounded have to be brought in by sledge at night in order to avoid being seen by the enemy, and so they freeze all over again before they reach us. Because the Russian is always attacking, driving his hordes ever onwards, there are always wounded and dead for us. Accordingly, the doctor's work is never ending. They toil and operate all through the night. Worst of all are the wounds that hit the stomach and the bowels, usually inoperable despite all the means available to us." The winter of 1941 to 1942 was also the first time the Germans themselves employed scorched earth. On 22 December, the 25th Infantry Division ordered, "The non-able-bodied male population and the general female population are to be driven east. Accepted are Wehrmacht-appointed mayors and their families. The remaining male population is to be taken behind our position with horse-drawn sledges, work equipment and provisions, and set to building defences. All villages, wells, buildings, supplies of straw, hay, etc. are to be destroyed, copses and small wooded areas cut down, standalone buildings not used for our own artillery are to be razed to the ground. The landscape is to be mined as far as mines are available." Soldiers noted the cost for the occupied population, but still deemed such measures cruelly necessary. Lance Corporal Werner F., serving near Tichwin at the northern end of the front, recounted his experience of one village. "On a corner I saw two girls, one named Manya, who has lived near us and who waved at us somewhat helplessly. We already knew full well the fate that awaited this very hospitable village. Within a few days it would have to be razed to the ground. Very hard for the inhabitants who now had to retreat back into the forest bunkers. But war demands ruthlessness, and we must not leave any winter quarters for the Russian troops." Desperate troops also plundered the population for supplies. For instance, the 123rd Infantry Division, serving in Army Group North, not only burned down villages from which it was retreating, but also ordered all felt boots are to be taken immediately from the population without consideration of age or sex. In the middle of winter, this order was a death sentence for civilians. Divisions ordered their men to be hard in the face of the population's suffering. On 6 January, the 126th Infantry Division, another Army Group North formation, proclaimed, "The all-too-trusting nature of the German soldier is all too often exploited to his disadvantage. Caution and suspicion should therefore be shown towards the Russian population. Scorched earth and all its attendant civilian misery would become a regular weapon in the German armory throughout the rest of the war." Indeed, the 126th Infantry Division, for one, was further hardened, indeed radicalized, by the winter crisis. One soldier wrote of his murderous rage towards these damned Russians, and men from the division also discovered several Germans whose bodies had been mutilated by the Soviets. The 126th troops committed several massacres of captured Red Army soldiers during January 1942, and divisional command reported, "As a result of the bestial murder of German prisoners and wounded, such a great bitterness prevails in the fighting troops that the repeatedly given order to take prisoners away is no longer obeyed." Difficult as it is to compare systematically the behavior of different divisions during the mayhem of the winter fighting, the 126th Infantry Division's troops behaved more brutally during these months than did two other Army Group North Infantry Divisions that have been studied particularly intensively, the 121st and the 123rd. All three experienced similarly ferocious conditions during the winter of 1941 to 1942, but while only informed speculation is currently possible, two things in particular may have lent the behavior of the 126th rank-and-file troops an especially vicious edge. Firstly, some of the 126th units found themselves under temporary command by 2 SS Brigade, and it is likely that that formation's own way of doing things rubbed off on the 126th. Secondly, the division was a highly homogeneous formation from Catholic Rhineland-Westphalia. Catholicism had been waning as a badge of identity in that particular region, and to compensate, many of its inhabitants came to identify more strongly with a greater German imperial mentality. In short, their chain of command and their regional origin may have rendered the 126th Infantry Division's men more susceptible to a ferocious National Socialist view of warfare. The winter fighting of 1941 to 1942 was certainly the kind of setting likely to bring this to the fore. A prominent reason why Hitler's standfast order worked in the winter of 1941 to 1942 was that the Red Army was very far from being a war-winning force. As masterminded by Stalin, the Soviet counteroffensive was actually a series of smaller offensives, none of which was powerful enough to bring decisive results. In particular, the Soviets spread their tanks too thinly across operations. Light formations such as ski troops, cavalry, and paratroopers could disrupt German communications on or near the front line, but could not permanently block railways and roads or capture villages the Germans had fortified. And the Red Army's offensive tactics remained crude and costly. Still deprived of sufficient armored punch, they continued to rely heavily upon mass infantry assault. There was no mistaking Red Army soldiers' resilience. The 25th Infantry Division described the great majority of Soviet prisoners it took as naive and childish and lacking either Bolshevik or nationalistic fanaticism, but it nevertheless acknowledged, "The units these people belong to have fought with a stubborn bitterness. After one attack, during which 60% lay dead or wounded, bleeding on the iron-hard battlefield, the survivors who had seen the horrors of the previous day attacked over the same field again the very next day, in wrathful yet stupefied disregard for death." By the beginning of February, despite much ferocious fighting to come, the front-line situation was starting to stabilize. Eventually, the Red Army's offensive was blunted by the German Army's pugnacious defense and by the spring thaw. Indeed, the mud that the thaw brought mired the Red Army just as surely as it had mired the Germans the previous autumn. In the rear, another crisis was unfolding, this time affecting Soviet POWs. On paper, German plans for the invasion of the Soviet Union had held out the prospect of decent treatment for the majority of Soviet POWs, those who were not communist functionaries or Jews. On 16 June 1941, the OKW had stated that Though the Soviets did not recognize the Geneva Convention, the Germans would still act in accordance with it. However, Hitler had openly stated in the run-up to Barbarossa that captured Red Army personnel should not be viewed as fellow soldiers. On 3 April, the OKH had declared that Soviet POWs would be a valuable workforce, even though the Geneva Convention forbade POWs from being used for work with a military dimension. The spirit of the criminal orders, combined with the anti-Slavism and anti-Bolshevism already ingrained in many officers and soldiers, was also bound to affect how the troops in the field handled their POWs. But the most basic reason why POWs could expect a miserable fate was the OKH's callous indifference to the need to plan and provision the POW camps. For one thing, the OKH expected the Wehrmacht to capture up to 2 million Red Army soldiers during the campaign's first 6 to 8 weeks, yet made no provision for such huge numbers. It did not require brilliant logistical deduction to recognize that if German troops were going to live off the land during the campaign and surpluses were to be returned to the Reich, there would be nothing left for the prisoners. And even when the Germans eventually recognized that their need for native agricultural labor demanded that the occupied Soviet population needed feeding to some extent, this still left POWs entirely out of consideration. In the event, the OKH made a token effort to feed the prisoners, but the derisory amount they received fell way short of what they needed to survive. In any case, as the ongoing fighting put further pressure on German resources, POWs' already pitiful rations were the first to be cut. For instance, the OKH's regulations of 6 August 1941 set them at no more than 2,200 daily calories. For most Soviet POWs, if hunger itself did not kill them, what assuredly would were the conditions of winter and the diseases to which hunger made them more susceptible. Although disease became more rife in the camps during the winter, death was visiting the POWs in various forms as early as the summer. From mid-July 1941, commandos from the Einsatzgruppen were given unlimited access to the POW camps to execute Soviet commissars. There were rare instances of camp commandants who actively sought to hinder the actions of the commandos. One example was Major Wittmer, who commanded the Durchgangslager transit camp Dulag 185 near Mogilev. However, Wittmer did not receive the support of his superiors, and the 403rd Security Division's intelligence officer, Lieutenant Scheiber, admonished the commanders of the Dulags and the Feldkommandanturen in his division's jurisdiction for weakness displayed that is completely out of place in a transit camp. It seems from this that the camp authorities were trying to spare commissars from execution. More often, however, commanders of both the Stammlager, permanent camps or Stalags, in the rear areas and the Dulags near the front line readily assisted the SS commandos, using informers from the anti-Bolshevik elements among the POWs, particularly Ukrainians and Balts, to weed out the commissars. The Wehrmacht's own GFP was also involved. While SS and police units selected and murdered prisoners who were commissars or, increasingly, Jews, many prisoners who did not belong to either group were dying as early as the summer due to the unsystematic but sustained maltreatment being meted out to them by the camp guards. Prison camp guard contingents generally came from older age groups and were drawn from static occupation units called Landesschützen battalions. Unless they came from those more easterly parts of Germany that had experienced centuries of confrontation with the Slavic East, they were generally less likely to harbor strong anti-Slavic sentiments than their more Nazified younger comrades. But they were likely to be brutalized by the conditions in which they worked. Above all, they were numerically overwhelmed. For instance, in Dulag 203, in Army Rear Area 580, 150 guards were responsible for 30,000 prisoners. Guards were issued with higher alcohol rations to help them cope, but the likely effect on their temper and their propensity to lash out can be easily imagined. It is particularly telling that the OKH eventually had to ban them from using clubs on the prisoners. Boredom and peer group brutalization may have contributed as well. For example, Captain Langer, who worked at Dulag 131 in the jurisdiction of the 221st Security Division, admitted to his Soviet captors after the war that shooting of prisoners had been a daily occurrence. By September 1941, the general death rate among Soviet POWs had already reached 10%. The potential for calamity was further increased by the general condition of the camps. The military planner's original intention was to keep most prisoners in gulags in the army-occupied areas of the Soviet Union, then ship them west to stalags in the Reich Commissariats and in the general government in Poland. However, the periodically huge influxes of surrendering Red Army troops